particular interest for our community, and because it has that interest alone, would be a reason that we're sitting here tonight. But one of the reasons that
the reason, Rabbi, I didn't hear you.
It's fantastic.
Everything's fantastic.
Everything's fantastic. When you're here, everything's fantastic.
Okay.
So if it was just for it being Aleppo, an Aleppo codex, we would be here tonight.
I was in Aleppo.
At the Tome. You want? Is this your guy?
We're the only two that born in Aleppo here.
Eli, you're born where? In Israel?
Israel.
But there's also a powerful reason that we're here tonight at this time, because there was a book that was written, which many of you read, which describes the tortured history, to some extent, of the Aleppo Codex. There have been a number of books that were written about the Aleppo Codex, the most recent one by Marty Friedman, which many of us have read the book, and if you saw also the article in the New York Times, which followed the book by, I think, a couple of months, right? Yeah, by a couple of months, was really brought it to the attention of all of the United States, maybe the world. We have the pleasure tonight of having a scholar in the person of Rabbi Hidri to talk about this. For him, it's really a labor of love to talk about issues of history and Tanakh and the Jewish community, and particularly the Halabi, the Syrian community. So we have the pleasure of having him. Before I introduce Rabbi Hidri, I just want you to know that Eli Sabag, I spoke about him just briefly in Shul, his father was one of the gentlemen, which you read in the book, his father was one of the ones that took out one of the pieces, a piece about this big, right, Eli? It was that big, right? About that big of the Aleppo Codex. And he had it, and just about 2 years ago, was it, Eli? Right, just about 2 years ago, we attended a ceremony in his home where he donated it back to the State of Israel. Wow. And right now, where is it, Eli?
The Ben Zvi Institute in Jerusalem.
Ben Zvi Institute. So we have one of the two people who brought out, at least from what we know, and that's part of, I guess, what we'll talk about tonight, we have one of the two people as part of our synagogue who have had first-hand contact with the Aleppo Codex. Rabbi Hidri.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Rabbi. Thank you all for inviting me. You can clap after if I do a good job. When you look at history, sometimes there are amazing coincidences. For example, 1492, the same king and queen that who expelled tragically the Jews from Spain also sent Columbus on a voyage to discover America. He didn't know that he was going to, that would ultimately be the safe haven for the Jews, second only to the land of Israel. And so sometimes Hashem is, as the Gemara says, Makdim refuah lemakah, he sends the cure before the disease. And so there's other cases like that. And the one I want to focus on tonight are the events of November 29th, 1947, which is famous for more than one event. So of course the most famous thing that happened on November 29th is the vote of the partition of Israel in the UN, which effectively created the State of Israel, right? The most amazing miracle in modern times. At the same time, though, a couple of other things happened. So one is that just a couple of days later, on December 1st, the Jews in Aleppo felt the vibrations from that vote, and there were riots in the streets. Estimates are that 75 Jews were killed during those riots, and many synagogues and schools and community buildings were burned down. So that's the negative side of it. But something else also happened on November 29th, which is that the first three of the first seven Dead Sea Scrolls to be discovered were acquired by the State of Israel. A professor by the name of Eliezer Sukenik went into a car undercover and drove to Jordan and met an antiquities dealer there, who had the first seven of the scrolls that were found by the Bedouin, and he made a deal, and he bought those three. And among those three was a copy of Sefer Yeshayahu. And that would now become the oldest copy of any biblical book that we have. So before we found the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Aleppo Codex was the oldest. It's about 1,000 years old. But once we found the Dead Sea Scrolls, we found something even older, something that's 2,000 years old. This was tremendous. And over the next few years, we would find copies of most of Tanakh in the Dead Sea set, in among the Dead Sea Scrolls. And I actually have a copy of all of them on my iPhone. So it's pretty. That's even more amazing. So it would seem like we're in good shape, and we have fantastic old copies of Tanakh. The thing is, it's very difficult to maintain a perfect copy of any book in olden days, before computers, before digitizing, before printing. How do you maintain a perfect copy of a book? Is it possible? Torah itself is about 80,000 words, which means that if a scribe is 99% accurate, he's still going to make 800 mistakes. Right? And nowadays, we still have scribes writing by hand, and even the best scribes will make dozens of mistakes when they write a Sefer Torah and have to be computer-checked again and again to get all those mistakes out. Right? It's basically impossible with human error to have a copy that's perfect. And so we look at the Dead Sea Scrolls in hopes that, well, here we have the oldest scrolls and the most perfect copies of Tanakh. But when scholars started reading the scrolls, they saw that the people that copied these scrolls were not careful at all in copying. In fact, they would add lots of things. Anytime something didn't make sense, they would add some words in to make it make more sense. Or if a word that was hard to read, they would add yuds and vavs and other vowel letters to make it easier to read. They didn't seem to have a problem. They didn't seem to have this idea that you have to copy it exactly letter for letter. And so when we look at the scrolls, it's very difficult. I'll just give you one example. Something that you say every day, right, goes in Aleph Bet, Aron Mechal Okay HaMelech, but there's one letter that's missing, right, the Nun, there's no Pasuk for Nun. There's lots of explanations why there's no Pasuk for Nun, and so we always wonder why. The scribes of the Dead Sea Scrolls also wonder, how come there's no Nun? But they decided to make one up. And so if you look at the Dead Sea Scrolls, sure enough, it's there. It says, Ne'eman Elokim Bidvarav, Vechasid Bechol Ma'asav. So they had to have a Pasuk for Nun. And some scholars think that that must be the original because, you know, otherwise it's missing. But if you look carefully, you see Bechasid Bechol Ma'asav is the same ending as Tzadik Hashem Bechol Derecha, Bechasid Bechol Ma'asav. So it's not very likely that the same exact words would repeat twice and the same is more, right? It's much more likely that the scribe just borrowed a piece from here and a piece from there and stitched together his own pasuk and put it in. So sometimes the Dead Sea Scrolls are very important. Sometimes they preserve a version of the Tanakh that was behind the Septuagint. But lots of other times, the scribes played fast and loose. So even though we have a copy that's 2,000 years old, it's still not so great. And in fact, the best copy that we have is the Aleppo Codex. Even though it's only 1,000 years old, it was preserved so much better that it's much better than the 2,000-year-old copies. Right? So that's just an amazing fact in itself. So what's so great about the Aleppo Codex? I actually have a copy of it here. You're welcome to look at it afterwards. Can I ask you to hand these up? Okay. So what's so important about the Aleppo Codex? And if you lived in the olden days and you wanted to preserve an exact copy, how would you do it? Right? You know there's going to be mistakes. So one way to do it is to have a master copy. Right? It's impossible. We know that every time it gets copied, there's going to be mistakes out there. But we know that if we have one copy that's perfect, so we'll keep that one copy in a centralized location. And that way, anyone who has a question can come and take their text and compare it to the master version. Right? Or if they can't come, they can send a letter. Can you please look this up? We want to know what it is. So as long as you have one perfect copy in one place, you'll be okay. And in fact, during the time of the second Beit HaMikdash, that's exactly what they had. They had Sefer HaAzara, the Sefer that was in the Beit HaMikdash, and that was the original copy, and everything else should be compared to that one. Seems like a good system, right? Here's the problem. If you the back of the page with the English quotes a midrash, very old midrash from the times of the Tanaim, that says there were actually three scrolls in the temple, one of Me'onim, one of Hihi, and one was called the Scroll of Zatutim. What does this mean? One of them had Me'onim. We just had Simchat Torah, right? Me'ona Elokekedem, right? So we have, instead, in two of the scrolls it had Me'ona, like we have in all of our scrolls. But in one of the scrolls had Me'onim instead of Me'ona, right? So the three master scrolls that were in the Beit HaMikdash had differences among themselves. He, a lot of times in Torah, there's a who that looks like he, right, if anyone's a reader. So in most, two of the scrolls had 9 of those, but one of the scrolls has 11 of those. And the other one, Zatutim, this is the young people after Matan Torah, they had some prophetic vision, and they're called Zatutim. In one of the manuscripts, other manuscripts are called Ne'arim. And so even among these three best manuscripts, there were some differences. And what they ended up doing is they took the majority of those three, and that became the official text. Okay. So you see that even going back to the times of the Beit HaMikdash, there were some questions about what's going on. And here's a very important Gemara, the next source, that says the early sages were called Sofrim. What does Sofrim? Sofer is also a scribe. But why were they called Sofrim? Because Sofrim also means to count. They would count all the letters in the Torah. And they said, they counted all the letters. They said, what's the middle letter of the whole Torah? And they said, it's the Vav of the word Gachon in Sefer Vayikra. That's the middle letter. And then the rabbis were discussing. They said, is that the middle letter from the beginning or the middle letter from the end? In other words, they're assuming that there's an even number of letters. So if there's an even number of letters, then there's actually 2 middle letters. So which one is it? So the other rabbi said, well, bring out the Sefer Torah and we'll count. Right? Might take all day, but we'll count and we'll figure out what the answer is. And the other rabbi says, no, we can't figure it out because we are not proficient about the vowel letters, the yuds and vavs, which serve as vowels. Sometimes you can insert them or not insert them without changing the meaning. And we're not sure which yuds and vavs are supposed to be there and which are not supposed to be there. So you see, even from very early on, the times of the Talmud, they weren't sure which yuds and vavs should be there. So you see that this master copy strategy is good, but it's not perfect. So what's a better way to ensure that we can preserve an exact copy of the Tanakh? So the second way is what the Aleppo Codex does. And it does it by a system of redundancy. Even in computers, you know, we think computers are perfect, but especially early computers, when they had to transmit over staticky lines, they would mistake zeros and ones might get flipped. And so in every, I'm a computer science major, so I happen to know this. In every byte is made of 8 bits, 8 zeros and ones. But every byte actually only contains 7 bits of information. The last bit is a check bit. It just counts how many, is there an even or odd number of ones, right? And if it's even, it'll be 0. If it's odd, it'll be 1. And that way, if there's a mistake in one of them, it'll check, and then you'll know, oh, that transmission wasn't good. Right, so it's a redundancy, and you have redundancies a lot. And I'm sure if you have computers, you have a backup in some other place. So in case one goes wrong, you can cross-reference it and check it. So in the Aleppo Codex, exactly what they have. They made an ingenious system about how to figure it out. And so if you turn on the second side of the page, this is actually a copy of one page of the Aleppo Codex. And so you have to notice a few things. First of all, you see it has tamim and nekudot, just like we have in our Tanakh. If you look in the Dead Sea Scrolls have no tamim and nekudot, right? Because originally all we had was the letters themselves, and there was an oral tradition about how to pronounce the words and how to chant it, but it was not written down. And then after a few generations, they came up with different symbols about how to, in other words, instead of adding an aleph to say ah, they would add a little aleph on top, and that became a kamatz. Right, or a little yud that became a chidik, right? So you have these different systems. Actually, there were 3 different systems about how to make notes of the vocalization. And by time this was written in the year 930, so there was already a complete system. This was created in Tiberius, the Tiberian system. So you have all the tamim and the kudot here. Second thing you might notice is on top it says Velo Yigael. I underlined that. This was added in later, some centuries after the original codex was written. On the other side of the page, it'll say Lo Yimached Velo Yigael, which means this manuscript shall not be sold and shall not be redeemed. Now, why would you say it shouldn't be redeemed? Wouldn't you want to redeem it? The point is, if you say we're not going to redeem it, then it will prevent people from stealing it in the first place. They might have added this after it actually was stolen by the Crusaders, or maybe before, and the Crusaders didn't care. Okay, so it says that on many of the pages. Okay, next thing you might notice is that we have 2 columns. For most of Tanakh, Aleppo Codex is famous for having 3 columns, right? Open any page, you see that there's 3 columns here. The reason why there's 2 columns here is that's the Book of Tehillim. And in the book of Tehillim, the writer wanted to make sure it looked like poetry, so you have, you know, two kola for each line, and you can only fit that if you have two columns. Okay. So the next thing we can notice is that we have the text in the middle, but then there's also these little letters all around in the middle, on the margins, on the top and bottom margins. See, there's all these little letters, right? What is that? You don't have that usually in your chumash. Okay, so I'm not assuming anybody can read Hebrew, but if you know the letters, you'll be able to follow. So I want to give you one example of what these notes are. These are called Masoretic notes, and these are actually cross-references that tell you how many times this word appears throughout Tanakh. So here's one example. I circled right in the middle. I circled the word daka. You see that? Okay. So the word daka here is spelled dalet kaf aleph. And if you look on the left, it says a little letter dalet, and then after that a little letter gimel. And so this gimel is telling you that the word daka is spelled exactly in this way, dalet kaf aleph, and it appears three times in Tanakh. Right? So they knew the whole Tanakh by heart. This appears three times. So in other words, what would happen if some scribe should come one day and misspell the word? Right? Spell it with a hey instead of an aleph. Right? Then they would look on this note and see it says gimel there. It has to be three of them. Someone must have made a mistake. And then you go through them and then you figure out which one is the mistake. Got it? Yeah, right.
That word has a problem.
I'll tell you, I'll get to that in a minute. Now, if you might say, well, this is a little difficult, it's three times in Tanakh, how do I know where they are, right? So that's why you get the Misorah Gedolah, the large Misorah on the bottom, which I made in a square. It actually brings the three times, it brings a quotation of the three times it appears in Tanakh, so you can go there and look. And in fact, if you go to those places and look, in the Masoretic notes there, it will also say Gimel. So every Masoretic note is cross-referenced with each other. That way, if any scribe should ever make a mistake, they just cross-reference the notes, and they'll find the mistake. Right? So it's absolutely amazing and ingenious system. Okay. Now, this word in particular is very interesting for us, because the word appears also in Sefer Devarim, Lo Yavo Fitsua Daka. And that word, if you look in Tanakh that we have in our Batek Nesiyot, there's a couple that you probably are familiar with. What you'll see is that in this Tanakh, it's spelled with an aleph, and this Tanakh, it's spelled with a hey. Right? So, what's going on? Right? Which one is it? Now, if we want to look and see what does the Lepo Codex say, the Lepo Codex is the oldest and most perfect copy. Right? So we can look there and find out what it is, but that part is missing, right? We don't have most of the Chumash. And so we don't know what the Lepo Codex says about that word. However, we have the Lepo Codex for Tehillim. And Lepo Codex for Tehillim says the word Daka appears three times, and on the bottom it quotes the one from Sefer Devarim, right? So therefore we can fill in the gap, and we know that the Lepo Codex had the one with an Aleph, and therefore that's the part one that we should go with, right? So it's amazing. It really works, and it really came in handy in our own time. Okay. So that's why the Lepo Codex is so fantastic.
Why do we use the other match?
Why does the Tanakh not have it as an aleph then?
Because there were other manuscripts that had it as a hey.
But this is the best. Why didn't they make them all olives?
Why did the printers make them all olives?
Yeah, exactly.
The Lepo Codex, you know, kind of just came out, and so Hebrew University and Bar Ilan are both have been now in the past few years working on Tanakhs that are in alignment with the Lepo Codex. So this is a process that has taken years to do. When they first made these older Chumashim, they hadn't done
it. Is it clear that everybody agreed that the Lepo Codex was the best? Maybe there was some tradition in the late.
Different traditions.
Right, and there are different traditions.
There are different traditions.
Look, so here's I'm gonna show you an example of I'll tell you an example now. There's one more difference between a really glaring difference between the Lepo Codex and all other codexes, and that relates to Parashat Ha'azinu. If you look in Ha'azinu, which we have in here, and Ha'azinu has to be written in a special way in two columns, because it's a poem, right? And if you count the number of lines throughout the poem, what you'll find in the Lepo Codex is that there are 67 lines. If you open up the Sefer Torah and the Hechal here, I haven't looked at this specific one, but I'm sure that it has 70 lines. And in all other, all Chumashim and all Sifrei Torah have 70 lines. Right? So this is an important difference. This difference, in fact, is a clue to the Rambam, right? Because the Rambam says, there are many, this is actually the last source on that, on the page I gave you, so look at that now. The Rambam says, in the laws of Sefer Torah, he says, I saw serious errors in these matters in all the scrolls that I have seen, while the authorities of the Masorah differ. I deemed it fit to write here a list of the sections which are closed and which are open, and also the forms of the songs of the Bible, so that all scrolls may be corrected from and compared with them. Right, the Rambam says, I see that many of the scrolls around Egypt are different, and they're different in the paragraphing and in the way they write these. They write the poems. So he's going to write a master Torah so that everybody can compare it to him. He actually did write a Torah, but we don't have it anymore. The book which I relied on to check the scrolls is the well-known Codex in Egypt, which contains the 24 books and that had been in Jerusalem for several years, and upon which all relied because it was proofread by Ben Asher, who worked on it carefully for many years and examined it again whenever it was copied. This codex was the text which I relied upon in the Torah scroll that I myself wrote according to the rules. So this is a description of the codex written by Ben Asher. Sounds very much like it is the Aleppo Codex. And for many centuries, it was assumed that the Rambam saw, they had the Aleppo Codex, and that was his basis. However, Professor Kasuto, who's mentioned in the book, he was one of the people that visited and saw the Aleppo Codex himself. When he looked at the Aleppo Codex, he concluded that this was not the Codex that the Rambam had. I'll tell you why. Because if you open up a book of the Rambam in Mishneh Torah, maybe you have one on the shelf here, you'll see that when he tells you how to write Parashat Ha'azinu, he says to write it in 70 lines, just like we have in our Sifrei Torah. But the Aleppo Codex, remember, has 67 lines. So it cannot be that the Rambam had the Aleppo Codex, right? Because he says 70 lines. And for a few years after Kasuda wrote that, everybody said, okay, he's right. The Rambam must have some other codex that was also written by Ben Asher, and it also happened to be in Egypt, and also had a tradition of being very old. Okay, but it's not the Aleppo Codex. Until one other professor, named Moshe Goshen Goldstein, he checked the manuscript of the Rambam, of the Mishneh Torah. And he found in the manuscript of the Mishneh Torah, he says to write only 67 lines. Right? So what happened is, pious printers, they were uncomfortable that our Sifrei Torah go against the Rambam. Right? So instead of changing the Sifrei Torah, they changed the words of the Rambam.
Even the Halabi checked the Sefer Torah, and they had 70 lines.
Right. Even in Aleppo, they did not write the Sefer Torah according to the Aleppo Codex. And so this brings up, I mean, really, if you had just to think about it on your own, which makes more sense, 67 or 70?
70
makes more sense. It's very strange. It's the same exact words. It just doubles up certain lines. You can see that they're very long, those lines. And it's still a big mystery. Why does the Aleppo Codex double up those lines? It seems very strange, and 70 would seem like a better number. So in this case, there might be two very old traditions, and maybe equally valid, about how to write the Parashat Ha'azinu, and therefore there's no need necessarily to go and change everything according to the Aleppo Codex. All other codexes, all other manuscripts, everybody else has 70 lines, so there must be something to that also. Right? So we're not always sure that the Aleppo Codex is 100% correct, but it is still the best. Now, why do we say it's the best? Number one, because the Rambam says it's the best, right? So that's a good enough reason on its own. The second reason why we say it's the best is because it's the only codex that's internally consistent. In other words, the Masoretic notes match the text exactly. If you look at the second best manuscript, the Leningrad Codex, right, which was written 70 years later and was proofread based on the Aleppo Codex, you'll see that a lot of times in the margin it'll say, this appears three times, and you look at actual text, it only appears twice, right? So no, they don't match up exactly. The scribe didn't take the time to go through it that carefully to make sure that you have to copy the Masoretic notes also, so mistakes can come up in there, and mistakes can come up in the text, and right, the job of making it perfect. Aleppo Codex is the only one where the notes on the margins, right, all those cross-references match exactly the text inside. So that's a good reason to take it very seriously whenever we have a question. Okay, so this pretty much resolves the question of how to preserve a document before we have printing. You know, one of the great printing is probably the greatest invention in terms of publishing, but the greatest invention before that was actually the codex. I should explain what a codex is. Codex just means a book, and the book was a great invention because before that everybody used scrolls, right? And the problem with scrolls is everybody knows is that if you're all the way in Sefer Devarim and you want to read something in Sefer Bereshit, you have to sit there for 10 minutes and roll the scroll. Okay, it's not easy to do. There's in fact a story in the Gemara about Rebbe Akiva's son who married a woman and he was learning and his wife would stay up all night and roll the scroll back and forth for him, right, for the page. And then he says he's a good wife and she's excellent, right? But if you have a codex. Codex is a book you could just flip open to any page you want instantly, right? And it took centuries for anyone to figure out that this would be a good thing to do. Also, a codex is better because you can write on both sides of the page in a codex, right? So you only have to use half the material. In the Megillah, you only write on one side. Okay, so the Romans invented the codex, and it was then adopted for Sifrei Torah, for regular books, but not for Sifrei Torah. Interesting is that the Karaites do use a codex in their public reading, in their synagogues. Okay, so that brings us to the next section, which is the history of this codex itself. It was written in 930, right, by Haron ben Asher, is one that wrote the Masoretic Notes and then Talmim and Nekudot, and Shlomo ben Buya'a is the one that actually wrote the letters. So they collaborated on this. And its first owner, after the original writers, was actually the Karaite community in Israel. They bought it, and it was in their use. They allowed everybody to come and see it, but it was a Karaite work. And some people actually think that Adon ben Asher himself may have been a Karaite, but there's no proof, actually, either way about this. During the Crusades in 1099, the Aleppo Codex was captured by the Crusaders, and it was redeemed by the community in Cairo. They put up money for it, and there's a great line there about how we put together lots of money, and we were able to redeem the books and the people too. Right? That's how important this was. And over there, it was owned and used by the Rabbinite community, right? The community of rabbis, not the Karaites, even though it was actually a large Karaite community there. And this is actually another amazing thing of history, that the Karaites and the rabbis, who disagreed about so many things, were able to agree on the exact text of what the Tanakh is, which is really important. I mean, throughout history, all different sects of the second Beit HaMikdash and nowadays and different times, right, we disagree on lots of questions of philosophy and halakha, but it's the text of Tanakh that actually holds us together. And that was true then as well. So it was in Cairo for that time, and then so the Rambam lives a few decades later, and he uses it and reads from it, and it was in the Rambam's family. And a couple of hundred years later, Rambam's grandchildren went to Aleppo, and they brought this book with them, and that's how it got to Aleppo. And so it was in Aleppo from 1400s all the way down to modern times. So for 600 years, Aleppo was the people that were in charge of keeping it safe. Okay, so the Aleppians do a good job in keeping it safe. Well, let's see. It was kept for the last decades in that locked box in the back of the Great Synagogue. Before that, it wasn't always in that place. Before that, it was actually, they put it in the oil storage room until there was a fire in that room, and they realized that might not be the best place for it. Also, sometime before the 1800s, a man named Firkovich, who was a Karaite book collector, actually came to Aleppo to try to buy it from them in any way he could. And he actually succeeded in surreptitiously getting access to it without going through the official community. And once the community found that out, they were even more vigilant than they had been before, because they saw that outsiders with negative intentions were around. And so that might have been part of the reason why they were so careful about who they let see it. So it is a good thing that they were very, very, very careful about who they let see it. But Some people might feel like they were a little too careful. So, for example, when Kasudo, the most respected Bible professors, from Italian Bible professors, who was also Shomer Mitzvah, when he came to see it, right, they wouldn't meet with him, and they said, we'll meet tomorrow, and they wouldn't show up to the meeting. And finally, they said, okay, you can see it for 15 minutes. Right? He wanted, you need hours and days and days with this. So finally, let him see it for a few hours, right? And this seems a shame. Second, they didn't photocopy it. If you have something valuable, you should photocopy it. Even the Dead Sea Scrolls, which they wouldn't let out for many decades, but they did photocopy it because they knew it's in Israel, it's a volatile place, and they sent copies of that to different libraries around the world just in case anything happens. And actually, sure enough, there's a lot of parallels between the Aleppo Codex and the Dead Sea Scrolls. But Dead Sea Scrolls also has a lot of controversy, and so how come we're not publishing them? Fine, we give you a right to publish them. It'll take a couple of years, but eventually you should bring them out. And scholars were just sitting on them and not publishing them until one day people were so fed up that one publisher got his hands on one of those copies that were supposed to be only for backup and actually published them. He ended up getting sued and lost in court, but he still did a great thing for the Jewish people to illegally photocopy the Dead Sea Scrolls. And so when we come to the Aleppo Codex, we see that the box that they stored it in was kind of a flimsy box. They just opened it up in the riots, and the leading authorities in Israel seemed to know that was not the best place for it, and so they sent the messenger Shamosh in 1943 to see if he could convince the Jewish community of Aleppo to allow him to buy it, take it to Israel, and so that it can be in safekeeping there, and can be studied in Hebrew University, and be the basis of a new Tanakh that would be based on this codex. And so Shamosh really hoped that he would succeed, but he got there, and right immediately he saw that the community just said, no, we're not interested, this is ours, we're never giving it to you. And then you have this fantastic story, when Shamosh is going back home, and a few people from the community say, hey, listen, you know the people who have the keys. Come here tomorrow with an empty suitcase, right? And we'll get it for you. We're going to steal it and smuggle it out of here, right? And Shamosh says no, because he's afraid of the curse, right? And it seems that the Aleppo Codex, when it was in Aleppo, was what?
I met Shamosh.
You met Shamosh. It seems that Aleppo Codex, when it was in Aleppo, was more venerated than actually read. Most of the people never saw it. Most of even the rabbis never studied it. There were some that did, like Menashe Sefihon. He has many letters of people from all over the world sending him, you know, what does it say in this word and that word, and he would check and he would write letters back, right? But otherwise, it was not used by, it seems like, once upon a time, there was a time when on Yom Kippur, they would bring it out and read Sefer Yonah from the Aleppo Codex, although not in recent centuries they didn't do that. Right? But most of the time, they kind of prayed to it, they lit candles around it, it was a kind of a magical thing. So it's nice that they kept it that way, because it was so magical, they kept it so tight, but they also didn't use it for its actual purpose, which is to be the authoritative master copy of Tanakh for everybody to use. So Shamosh did not, at that time, smuggle it out. And the question I want to raise for us is, would it have been right for the state of Israel to effectively steal it at that time? See, later on, you're going to have a court case, because Mr. Facham, my wife's great uncle, smuggled it out. And then there was a huge court case about, and so he smuggled it out and gave it to the president. And the question was he authorized to do that? Right? And so one side, the Aleppian rabbi said, no, the two rabbis in Aleppo gave it to him and told him to give it to Rabbi Yitzhak Dayan. He was supposed to give it to him. It was supposed to stay within the Syrian community. And Mr. Bacham said, no, they never said that. They said, give it to a religious man. And he did give it to a religious man. And he did his duty. And it belongs to the entire Jewish people. It belongs to the state of Israel. And that was the question I was going back. It was really like, what happened on that night when they were deciding to smuggle it out? And it seems strange to me that the question of where it belongs should really depend on these two rabbis and what exact language they said. It seems too important. I mean, there's a general question that comes up anytime there's communal property, it's not individual property, and that the community is disbanded, or institution is shut down, so what happens with the proceeds, right? This happened in this community, before Bikuch Olim was Ma'oz Le'Evion was shut down, right? But they still had money in the bank account. They had to decide, what should we do with that money? It has to go to some other community institution. It was given to Bikuch Olim and Megan David. So the question I was thinking about is, what if Israel did go and steal it? Would they have any legal right to do that? I was looking for some precedents that did happen in history that might shed light on it. You have a precedent?
I don't have a precedent, but I have a further question.
Yes.
The question is that if this happened in 1943, what entity was there to actually steal? Because there existed no state.
There's no state, but there was the Hebrew University.
That may be the case, but okay, so you're not talking about
the state. Right, you're right. So it wouldn't be the state, it would be the Hebrew University. So here's a couple of cases. I mean, it was originally written in Israel. So on August 19th, 1911, I'm not sure if you're aware, but the Mona Lisa was stolen. And it was gone for 2 years. Police could not figure out who took it. There was a security guard that had seen it right before, and then saw it after. He figured that some, you know, maybe a museum official took it, and they had no idea. Until one day, some art collector put out an ad, said, like to buy, you know, buy anything. And excuse me, the person that stole it, Vincenzo Perugia, actually contacted the person to try to sell it, and that's how they caught him. And they said, "Why'd you steal the Mona Lisa?" It was just to make money. This has nothing to do with money. I wanted it to be back in Italy. Right? Leonardo da Vinci was from Italy. It doesn't belong in France. It belongs in Italy. And that was his stipulation when he sold it, when he tried to sell it back, that it has to stay in the Uffizi Museum in Italy. Right? That's where it belongs. So he was arrested and he was convicted. Obviously, he was wrong. But in Italy, he was a national hero. Right, so there is a sense that the place where something is created is where it belongs. And in general, when there's so many cases of this happening, especially the archaeologists who went to the Middle East, the British archaeologists, and took all kinds of things from Greece and Rome and brought it back. And so now in Turkey and Iran, there's lots of cases that they want their stuff, demanding their stuff back from museums that are in Europe. That's one case. Second case is that in 2001, the paintings of Bruno Schultz were discovered in Poland. He was a writer and a painter in Poland, and when the Nazis came to power, one of the Gestapo ordered him to paint murals in his son's bedroom. And he said that way he would be saved. And he did paint those murals of Polish folktales. A few years later, he was shot by a different Gestapo officer. And in 2001, it was discovered that these murals were there. And Israel heard about it, and they sent in agents, undercover agents, and they went in and took the murals off the walls and brought them surreptitiously to Israel. And this caused a huge controversy. Many, even Holocaust survivors and people in Israel said, "You can't just take it that way." And other people says, "No, it belongs in Yad Vashem, and that's the right place for it to be." And still a controversy that hasn't been resolved. A third and last example is the Barnes Collection of art in Philadelphia. Barnes used $25 billion art collection that was stored in this Barnes special building that was meant to be a small building and meant to be for students to come and not open to the public. It was out in a suburb. And Barnes and his will, and the trustees, their mission was to keep it there, and every painting should be exactly where it is, and every little room that it's in. And then after he died, they had some financial trouble, and they said, "Well, we need to let more visitors in. We need to allow some of the paintings to go off on trips to raise money." And then there was complaints above the neighbors, and they decided they wanted to move the museum to the main city. Which was against the trusteeship, and it went to court, but the court allowed it anyway. What they actually did is they built an exact replica of the museum building in the city. That way, kind of got the best of both worlds. So, you know, there are cases when the original trustees could not have foreseen what would happen, and sometimes the court would rule that the trustees don't have to be listened to. So I'm just bringing it as a possibility that maybe Hebrew University had it right if they determined that the people in Aleppo were not taking proper care of it, and it should be open to the public, and it should be stored in a safer place. It's hard to argue that Israel at that time was a safer place, but as it turns out, Yitzhak Gad Yitzhak Ben Tzvi also didn't let anybody see it. Right, they only let a few professors see it, and they also didn't take care of it. It took many years until they actually did preservation work. So I'm not sure if they did a better job in the end, right? But anyway, at least I'm throwing that out as a possibility. Even Leo Towel, who saved the other page that was found in Brooklyn, he actually went to the site. I talked to him a few weeks ago. He went to the site of the synagogue after the riot, the day after the riots, and he found one page and he brought it home, and they realized what it was, and he took it back to Brooklyn, and now it's back in the museum. And he told me, he says the Kodesh doesn't belong to us; it's the property of the whole Jewish people, and that's where it belongs. Okay, so where are the missing pages? Anybody have them? No. For a long time, they thought it was burned.
Waiting for you.
Right? For a long time, I thought it was burned until they actually did some testing on the bottom. They thought it was burned because on the bottom it's a little bit brown on some of the pages, but they actually found it's mold. Right? So there's no signs of it being burnt at all. And the testimonies of many people who saw it in those intervening years said that the entire codex was there. And so, which means that somewhere along the way, something happened to it. And we're not sure. So a few of the theories that are presented, a couple are in the book. One is that this guy, pseudonymed Silo, is the one that took it. So this is actually a little strange that Matthew Friedman, in his book, he's very careful to present all information very accurately and clearly, but there's one person who doesn't give us a name for. Right? Silo is only a pseudonym of the agent in Turkey. And so that's the question. What's he hiding? Why doesn't he have that name? I know the name of the person. Somebody who was around there told me. So it seems that Matthew himself might be trying to protect someone who might have given him information. He accuses this book, Tayyim Tawil, of not revealing everything he knows, right? But maybe he's also doing the same thing. I mean, everybody has connections and things that they can reveal and not reveal. Okay, so that's one thing. So what's the first theory is that Silo, the agent along the way, we know that he seemed to have taken many things and money and different stuff from people that were traveling from Syria through Turkey. They're vulnerable. They have all their stuff with them. And so it's easy for them to take things. So that's one possibility that he took it. There's really no proof for it. It seems to be contradicted by the fact that it was in their luggage, and the luggage went into Turkish customs, and so Silo doesn't seem to would have been able to have access to it. I think they might have tolerated Silo taking stuff from other people along the way, but I don't think the government would have tolerated this kind of theft. I mean, Mr. Fakham would have said, this guy took it, and they would have investigated and found it. So it doesn't seem so likely. So Mr. Bacham, once he gets to Israel, gives it to this the customs official, the immigration official named Shragai. And so Shragai is right. He's the religious man that he gives it to. And Shragai says he gives it to the president the next day, but actually he kept it for a couple of weeks. And there are some indications that he maybe was thinking of keeping it, but he doesn't seem to have kept it. Since this book, Shragai's son has said that he remembers his father had the entire codex. And so if it was taken, it was not taken any time before Shragai had it. So Shragai seems to have given to the president, and it seems to have been intact at that point, because the earliest reports of what the codex looked like and the earliest court documents mention a few pages missing. That would be like the couple of pages that were found, and maybe there's a few more individual pages that people are still hiding. But it doesn't say anything about 200 pages being missing. And so the question is, where are those 200 pages? So this book concludes with the theory that the it was this person named Benayahu that took it. He was the deputy secretary in charge of the Ben Tzvi Institute. And we have many other cases where he took books didn't return them.
Do we have books?
Well, one of the proofs is Mr. Silvera. He's not here, right?
Does that accuse Professor Benayahu? He accused the Ben Tzvi Institute.
No, Benayahu.
Benayahu specifically also.
So specifically?
Mm-hmm. I have another story.
Okay.
It just reminds me of, you know, I have about 200 books out of the YU library, and they're all overdue, so they keep bothering me. So actually, this week on Tuesday, I brought them all back, like 5 cartons of books, and I go, okay, here. Right, they were all very happy. It's good to return your books. So Mr. Silvera himself, he smuggled out a smaller keter, not as important, but still important book, and he gave it to Benayahu, to the Ben Tzvi Institute for safekeeping. And actually, I have the letter here that says, it's a receipt, and says, we will never sell it, we will never give it away, it will never leave the Institute, right? But they can't find it now. So it's somewhere. This also comes...
He's actually suing the government.
He's suing the government, actively suing the government now, so we'll see. We'll see if he's able to get anywhere. Another example close to home: my wife's great grandfather, Yosef, great grandfather Yosef Binun, wrote some books and manuscripts, which they gave to Benayahu, and then my father-in-law wanted to publish it, so he asked Benayahu to have the books. So they can publish it, and Benayahu would not return it to them. And only after they went to court were they able to get copies of the book. So we see what, you know, what was going on. So that's the theory that the book concludes on. However, people that know Benayahu don't think that's true. I went to yeshiva with Benayahu's son. Many of you know his son. And it does seem to be true that he took books from the Institute. But what he did with them is put them in his house. And he liked to have them in his house. Sometimes he published articles based on them. But he wasn't selling them or profiting from them in any way. He wasn't that kind of person. And also, you know, if he would take the codex, he wouldn't like rip it in half and take half. He would take the whole thing. And to take it right under the eyes of the president's going to notice. I mean, he might not notice some, you know, little manuscript that he doesn't know about, but the president spent a lot of his life looking for this codex. It doesn't seem likely that he would be able to take it just like that. So, any other theories?
Yours. Your theory.
Yeah.
I would like to hear your theory.
Okay, I'll give you one.
I don't know if it's a theory, but it's a question. If you want to make a case against the Ben Tzvi Institute, mm-hmm. and the state of Israel, would it be wrong to look at the way they regarded Middle Eastern Jews in the early years, which was horrible, the ringworm and children and too many babies, like horrible things.
Right.
You could like make the case that they didn't really care much about Middle Eastern Jews, and they said, oh, here's a valuable thing. Syrian Jews. Oh,
right. So I think in general that's that's true, but in this case, the president had really personal vested interest in this particular book. So he really did care about getting this book and wasn't going to just throw it away.
I don't know that this is about Middle Eastern Jews. It's about a text that emanated from Eretz Yisrael. It came from Israel. It had its place in Aleppo for a while. But
I mean, I think you have a point in the way that they treated the Aleppo community. They said, oh, it's not, you know, you don't have rights. Who are you? We're just going to take it from you. We don't, right?
Right.
That part of it.
Benayahu was Farabi.
Israeli customs. It
was
a few months or something.
It was an Israeli customs.
Yes.
Okay.
And it seemed like they were hiding something. Could it have been stolen during that time by somebody else?
Right. It could be somewhere in customs. That could be another possibility.
The Arab dealer.
So there is talk that it was in. This Hasidic dealer seems to have had it and showed it to this Musayev guy, but he was killed in a hotel room. Right. I mean,
that's
this is the strangest story. You couldn't make up the story if you tried. Right. So maybe it's on the black market. Who knows? Another theory I had thought of during the summer is that maybe the rabbis in Aleppo had originally only given Mr. Facham half, kind of like, you know, Yaakov, he puts half of his family here and half of there, you know, just in case he gets caught and half gets destroyed, we'll have the other half to be saved.
We have witnesses that saw the Kodesh.
That's not even in Israel.
Even in Israel, they saw the Kodesh missing
Right. Wouldn't somebody commented on if that was
10 pages, 20 pages, and that's
it? The president said it's
right. Where's the rest of it? Okay. So let's scratch that. So here's the last theory.
Rabbi.
I have a document here.
I don't know, Rabbi, come join us.
I'm witness protection box. I have a letter here. This is a letter from Meir Lignato. Meir Lignato was a lawyer and the head of the Syrian community in Israel. And it's a letter to Meir Ben...
He was a military judge.
Excuse me.
Military judge.
Wasn't he also a mayor, I believe, of Tel Aviv?
No. Mayor Lignato?
No.
He was the son of Rav Shimon Lignato. It was the mayor of Tel Aviv.
Okay. It's a letter written to Meir Benayahu. Benayahu we just mentioned. It's a very interesting letter. It's an angry letter. And he says, I want to tell you that a few days ago, Mr. Isaac Shalom, right, from New York, showed me the letter that you sent to him. So it seems that Meir Benayahu sent a letter to Aishalom, asking Aishalom to get involved and to push the Aleppin community, Aleppin rabbis, to come to some kind of settlement, right? Some kind of deal that the government liked.
What date is this written?
With regard to what? With regard to what?
Regard the Aleppo Codex.
Ownership of it.
Right. This is about ownership of Aleppo Codex. This is in the middle of the court case, right? The court case is not finished until 1962. Uh-huh. Okay. So right in the middle of it, they're bypassing Meir Lignato, who represents the Aleppo community, and they're going straight to Aishalom, who's the rich person who can put pressure on the people he needs to put pressure on to accept the government's deal. Now, it doesn't give details of what the deal is and what they were trying to do, but I think we can at least see from here that the government was using any tactics possible. And he writes, he says, we don't do this anymore. Maybe a long time ago you get the rich person to come and sign something and everybody has to accept it, but we don't deal with that. We don't deal like that anymore. And he says... I have a lot of right on my side. I can go instead of they actually were in a rabbinical court, and we have some documents with the names of the judges even, who seem to be Rabbi Waldenberg, one of the most important Ashkenazi poskim, Rabbi Kaffa, right, the Yemenite scholar, Rabbi Avadah Yosef, I mentioned, but they never said anything about it. We don't know anything about that. He says, you know, I can bring it to the civil court. Right, the non-rabbi court, the non-rabbinic court, and I will win because I have the rabbis on my side. We have a great case, and we'll take it all for us. And we'll just take the Aleppo Codex back, and you'll have nothing. Right? It's better for you instead to agree to some kind of settlement where we'll have a joint trusteeship, which is what they end up settling on at the end. So it just gives us a little bit of a hint of what was going on. And there's another document where they actually say that the smaller codex, as part of the settlement, was given to the Aleppo community. And so we have to remember that this was settled out of court. And so settling out of court means that no one was allowed to say anything. Actually, in one of the early documents, it says the government says, let's keep this trial quiet, right? No one should be able to say anything about the trial. So we have to wonder, what was that settlement, right? How come the Aleppo rabbis, who had a good case, and could have continued pursuing that case, how come they all of a sudden decided to stop and say, fine, you keep the codex, and we'll just be honorary members of some kind of council? Is it possible that the first half of the codex was given to them, and as part of a deal, we'll take half, you take half, and everybody will say it was burned? It's just a possibility, just a complete theory. But I think that we owe a debt of gratitude to Matti Friedman's great research.
So according to that, where do you think it is?
Well, then the Aleppo community would have had to hide it somewhere because they can't admit that they found it, and maybe they sold it on the black market.
The Aleppo community who fought for 500 years to keep it in Aleppo?
In Israel. So there's no community, really. There's no community in Israel. Sorry, individuals.
Based on what the rabbis from Aleppo sent it to two rabbis or one rabbi in Israel.
Right. It didn't have to be right away. Maybe after they passed away, it went to who knows where, when, who, whose hands it got into.
Rabbi, the
yes.
letter that you were reading,
yes.
what year was that?
1960.
And rabbi, who wrote the letter?
Meir Lanyada.
Meir Lanyada was here in 59 or 60 in the U.S.
Yes.
He was my father's cousin.
Uh-huh.
Okay. He was here.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So he may have come here to see Aishalem or any one of the other people
right.
that were mentioned
mm-hmm.
in that.
Well, he was friendly with the Aishalem.
Yes.
Meir
Lanyada was friendly with Aishalem.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let me just wrap up, then I'll take questions. I think we owe a great debt of gratitude to Matti Friedman for doing all this hard work. And so we don't have conclusions yet, but I think because of what he wrote, we see a few articles came out in New York Times and other places, people going a little further and finding more clues. Ezra Kasson, who's mentioned in the book, seems to have many more documents. And I think in the coming years, we will see more information revealed. I think there is a good chance that sometime in our lifetimes, we'll be able to see the entire codex. So thank you so much.
Wow.
Any questions, comments, new theories, opinions? Happy to.
Many, many people in our community are very superstitious. We know that because of the Syrian culture.
Yeah.
And many people who probably having an opportunity taking pages would keep them in the thought of being a good
mm-hmm.
luck charm.
Mm-hmm.
So it wouldn't be uncommon to find it scattered around.
Yes, I would assume that there are...
That somebody had in their wallet for many,
yes.
many years that they talked about?
Yeah.
Okay,
I would assume that there are individual pages that are still around. After I gave a talk about this in the summer, actually, one woman did come over to me and said, my friend told me that she has a page. So I said, try to track it down. We don't even need the original. Just make a copy. Right? We just want the information in it. And I saw her more recently, and she said she tracked it down, and it was a page of another book. It wasn't the Aleppo Codex. So sometimes people don't even know exactly what they have.
Shamosh has another theory.
What?
Shamosh has another theory.
Yes.
Amnon Shamosh.
Mm-hmm. He thinks that the Aleppo Jews somehow...
Some Aleppo Jews bought it or something, or it's hiding.
From the...
The 200 pages, yes.
But they bought it from the Ben Tzvi. I mean, if you assume that
or
it was in the Ben Tzvi Institute...
Maybe from Syria, maybe, I don't know.
Right, I mean, there seems to be documents that it was in the Ben Tzvi Institute. So unless those... Look, we have lots of documents, and if you take all those documents to be true, then there are contradictions. So we can't take all of them, we can't assume that all of them are accurate. So the question is, which one is accurate, and which one do you throw out?
So you would not agree with the author's premise at the end, which is this one person who was indicted or who was accused of taking other books.
Right.
That you would not agree with his premise.
Right.
But that's how I finish the end. Mm-hmm. He seemed to feel that he was indicted.
Right.
That
seems to me to not be the most likely possibility.
And to answer your first question, which you started with, does the state of Israel, or the entity of Israel, have a right, an obligation?
Mm-hmm.
Obviously the answer is a very big no, because they took a document that was in perfect condition for 1,000 years, and they murked it. They destroyed it, and it's a mess.
Yeah. I mean, look, it happens
in
to be
their,
true
in
that...
In their purview,
right.
in their domain for years, and they didn't let
yes.
anybody touch it or go near it,
right.
and it's a royal mess.
Yeah. I think we have an assumption that museums and libraries are really good at keeping things in perfect condition. This summer I went to Yale University and I visited their cuneiform collections, cuneiform clay tablets from 3,000 years old. They have one of the biggest collections in the world. And so we had a big group there, but one of the guys saw me and says he stuck me in, and we actually saw the drawers and drawers full of them. And I asked him, are these photographed? He said, no, there's no photographs of any of them. Is that crazy? He says, well, it's hard to photograph. What do you mean it's hard? Just take your iPhone, get some student, give him 8,000 an hour, and photograph all of them. At least you have them. Yeah.
Well, the Dead Sea Scrolls, when they were originally, there's a lot of information that when they were doing Dead Sea Scrolls originally, there were guys that were smoking cigarettes.
They were smoking. We have pictures of smoking in front of Scotch
Tape. Not that they were sitting with the glass pieces. There's these famous pictures with the guys... with the glass pieces with the Dead Sea Scrolls all spread out, and the guy smoking a cigarette like this, not more than a foot away.
Yeah. I have personal experience. I had a class on the Cairo Geniza in graduate school, and our final paper was to go find a Geniza document and copy it out and write a commentary on it. So I went to the library around here that has Geniza documents in the JTS library. So I went there, I was looked through the catalog, there's one manuscript of Masechet Berachot. I said, this seems interesting, so you go to the rare book room, I ask them for it, they bring it out. right? It wasn't in any plastic or anything, just there. You touch the page to turn it, and it falls, you know, the corners fall off. There's nobody after, I kept going back there every week to work on it. After a few weeks, they finally put some kind of plastic cover on it, right? But it would have been easy to take a page out of it and take it home. Even in Yale, I said, what's to prevent someone who works here or somehow has access to take a piece? He said a better idea. He said, what you do is you take a piece of cuneiform, you break it in half, and you steal half. Right, because that way no one will ever notice even that anything's gone. Right, so you have an even better idea. Right, and this happens. So, I'm not justifying the way the Ben Tzvi Institute handled these things, but these things are unfortunately more widespread than we probably imagine.
I didn't finish reading Friedman, so I'm not sure. Was there testimony that Faham never took it as a package and never opened it? Or did Rav Faham actually open and see what the contents, what actually he was carrying?
It seems that they brought it to his house sometime in the middle of the night, and his wife wrapped it in a cheesecloth. He was a cheese merchant, right?
Yes.
And so they wrapped it in cheesecloth and put it in the washing machine, and they don't seem to have taken it out at all during the way, and they delivered it still in the cheesecloth. Actually, the Ben Tzvi Institute still has the cheesecloth, and I believe that Mr. Sitt actually bought the cheesecloth for his for the museum in the
last question to you,
Joey
Sitt.
On July 27th this year, they had an article in the New York magazine about the
Times.
About the quoted the journalist from Israel. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's Yedioth or Ma'ariv, that said that they paid a very large sum amount of money, unspecified large sum of money, to bring the codex to Israel, which is not true. So I think there's a conspiracy there, because somebody from the Ben Tzvi Institute must have said, okay, we're going to take $1 million or $500,000, we're going to bring the piece to Israel, which was not so. What it is, what it was, they spoke to my sister, and she said that now that my father passed away, the family would like to donate it to the Ben Tzvi Institute. Mm-hmm. And they said, since your mother wants to donate it, let her come to Israel. And my mother at the time was 85 or so, and she wasn't able to travel to Israel, so they said, you know what, we'll give you the plane ticket, go bring the piece. And we donated it, and we brought this professor from, I forgot, his last name was Cohen, was it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he came in, and he made a speech, and we gave it to him, and he said, okay, I'll give it back to you. You take it to Israel and give it to the Institute in Israel. And then the article came in Israel, the newspaper, that we got a lot, very large sum of money.
Right.
My sister said, where is it?
Albert, you gotta get a donation.
In,
yes.
Like you sold it to you.
Right.
Can I ask one more question? Not on this direct subject. Does anybody know what's happening today in Syria with the synagogue in Halab? Because the community spent a lot of money renovating that synagogue in the last few years.
Yeah, it's very difficult. It's a great question. I mean, we know the old shuk is now totally destroyed, and so much is destroyed. It's very hard to get any information. There was 60 Minutes just now about a reporter that actually made it in, and Bama was falling on her head while she was reporting. So I think it's going to take some time after the dust clears to assess what the damage is. This is these pages are actual size. Yeah, this is actual size.
The thickness. The book itself.
It's thicker. It's bound. Yes.
It was bound.
Yes. It's on parchment, so it's even thicker.
Albert, did you ever see it?
How could you carry it? Yes. Yeah. It's big.
Nobody could see.
Okay. No, I think he was in Halab.
If so, you think anybody
in Halab could see it? In a box.
It's not the box.
In
the book.
This case like this, nobody could
open it. Okay.
My father saw it. After the incident.
Right. So the one thing we learned from tonight is that we've just begun the discussion about this. Because thank you so much, Rabbi Hidari, for really...
Thank you.
Not only informing us, but getting us excited and
as I think it's pretty clear that the beginning, we're at the beginning of what's going to happen with the discovery of what really happened to the Aleppo Codex. Yeah. And maybe somebody in this room may even whisper something in your ear later on, and we'll have another lecture next year. But in the meantime, we really thank you very much for taking your time out and for joining us tonight. Please come back again.
If you want to see it, go to aleppocodex.org. The entire thing is online.
Not from Hazino, right?
From Hazino.
Thank you. You want to see my
No, it can't be a Hazino because it's like three columns.
No, this is the curses. It starts in the curses.
The Kilalot?
Yeah, it starts in the Kilalot.
I'll tell you what exactly.
It starts in the Kilalot.
Oh, you're about one, yeah, right.
Devarim, here you go.
Oh, there you go.
You're right.
You are the Torah reader, Morris. You read the Torah. Now in Parashat Vezot HaBeracha, how do you write? Vayeter Hashem, right? Look here. This is Vayete, not Vayete. It's on Akadma. We were discussing this with Norman.
It's not Akadma, it's a Terekadmi.
Yeah, but it doesn't have, here in the Aleppo Code, it does have a Terekadmi. It's only Akadma.
Okay, let's see.
That's what Norman showed me. He showed it to me. Norman Didier.
It basically makes no difference. It's a letter here, a letter there. It doesn't make any difference to me. It doesn't ever say, like, shadow and kill.
It's like a little upside
down.
It's a copy.
Any Tanakh is 99.9%. So it's really more about Tamim. Like, reading people to that. You know, right, so here and there, there's a difference in the Tanakh. Okay.
Based on all the moments, you know, all the killing, people that thought, letters, and everything.
I always thought that, how many pages were missing? And the book that people had that was still the first
book.
They had printed it, and how were they from the first book? Right, but were they from the later part?
Well, it's not that clear. Of course, even though there's a kadma over there, why is there a line? Why is there a line over the top? What's he trying to tell us there? Right here. No.
Actually,
I would read it according to this, assuming that this is a kadma. But yet, so that it's not by yete, that because that's a, there may be a much.
It's great. Let's make a movie out of it, huh?
It's really good.
Right, it's amazing. It's really